Township of McKeller Special Meeting of Council for June 26, 2024 to order. Start with roll call.
Counselor Morley Haskam.
Counselor Nick Ryland.
Counselor Debbie Zula.
Counselor Mike Heffernan.
Acting Clerk Charlie Britton.
Mayor David Moore. Any declarations of pecuniary and or personal interest in the general nature thereof? Hearing none. Resolution 24-392, moved by Counselor Kekkonen, second by Counselor Zulak. Be resolved that the Council of the Corporation of the Township of McKeller does hereby approve the agenda for the special meeting of Council as presented. Call the question. All those in favor? None opposed? Carried.
Here. So if you just want to put that on your shirt.
The spirit of reconciliation and cooperation. Wish to acknowledge that the land in which we gather is the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and the Mississauga people. Its boundaries fall within the Robinson-Huron Treaty of 1850 and the Williams Treaty of 1923. We are grateful to live here, and we thank all the generations of people who have taken care of this land for thousands of years. Honor the suffering of Indigenous people and the love and wisdom they have carried for thousands of years. We pledge to work in community and harmony with each other and the environment we inhabit, and work towards truth and reconciliation. Moving right over to 15, planning matters, the zoning bylaw and official plan preliminary meeting. And just a note here for the public that different from usual, this is a working session of papers that council has just viewed recently, actually just the official plan, not the zoning bylaw amendment. So we've gone back to the way it is on the agenda with the question comment period for public related items on the agenda. That would be at the end. And we'll be going through a working session, council talking to John Jackson, the planner, who has agreed to update our official plan and the zoning bylaw. So there shouldn't be any interruptions from the public as we go through until the very end, and then you can make comments with notes that you've taken perhaps throughout the meeting. And as I say, it is first of probably many meetings to come, and it is preliminary, and we're getting just a general idea of philosophy, I think, of where our planner is going with this. Okay, John, if you wish to come forward.
Good morning, Council.
Good morning, John. I'd like you to thank you for taking on this task here once again. You have a long storied history with the township, and we thought we'd lost you to retirement, but maybe if you could just start with a brief history. I know you've provided it to us, but of how we got to this stage and what we're trying to achieve and your general philosophy with the changes that you're recommending.
Brief is perhaps going to be difficult, but I'll try and give you the Reader's Digest version. I would say that McKeller was the municipality that was sort of the latest to the land use planning program in Westbury Sound. It was in many ways a municipality that was more interested in looking after the needs of its ratepayers rather than just grasping at restrictions for the sake of restrictions. And along the way, there were a lot of colorful comments and discussions with other agencies about what we felt was most appropriate for McKeller. And you kind of need to keep that backdrop in mind, because I in a certain sense, admired that, not so much rebellious attitude, but one that was looking after what you really truly believe was the needs of McKeller ratepayers. So our first official plan didn't come about until 92, not approved until 95 by the Ontario Municipal Board. And, there were rules that are still in place today that you're supposed to be cognizant of the fact that planning is dynamic. So every 5 years, you're supposed to update the policies and the implementing zoning bylaw. But things were actually such that McKeller wanted to resist a lot more of the kinds kinds of restrictions that seemed to evolve as land use planning programs occurred. So there were very few comprehensive updates along the way, but we recognized that you needed to, in fact, get in step with certain programs so that you could benefit, whatever those benefits might be. We did have a circumstance which was quite interesting where we updated the policy in kind of two components. The one component was the waterfront in response to some pressures for development, particularly along the waterfront, where we adopted new comprehensive waterfront policies back in 2013 under Official Plan Amendment Number 7 with all the color that was involved at that time. And then we went on to look at the non-waterfront or the rural areas, and we did that through Official Plan Amendment Number 8, and typically true to past was lots of color in respect to getting that. It actually boggled the minds of the province who, when they looked at the updates, thought, why didn't they do it all together? And it was very disconcerting because in the world of planning, land uses are governed by the province. We're kind of they're our stewards. We have to do what they want and they feel what's best for the municipalities, and they couldn't recognize that the evolution of McKellar's policies were quite different than norm. In any event, we wanted to bring the plan into sort of step with the needs of the province, the needs of the ratepayers, and there was an attempt to update the zoning bylaw so that it reflected this new combined OPA 7 OPA update, which was in two different silos, so to speak, one being the water, one being the rural. But at the time, the province has what is kind of like an official plan for the province, which is the provincial policy statements. And they review those every 5 years as well. And the program spanned the latest official plan or provincial policy statement, so we had not, in fact, considered in the new comprehensive zoning bylaw. And they said, well, hold on, when you're going to update the zoning bylaw, we want you to recognize the new 2001 provincial policy statement. So we're kind of out of sync with respect to that. So one of the things that we found we needed to do in the new bylaw program was to do some technical official plan amendments, and the province at the time was the approval authority, and it remains the approval authority, said, well, if you're going to update your official plan to deal with technical concerns, we want you to add these items, which were related to the 2001 or 2020 provincial policy statements, where we were only in step with the 2014 PPS. And now fast forward to today, there is an update of the PPS for April 2024, which has gone through the process, but it hasn't been given sort of final approval, and that may affect this whole program. So we have to almost be prepared to be a little bit fluid in this program, because although the legislature is not sitting, the provincial policy statements for 224 might appear, because it's gone through the environmental registry, and the good news is it's not that significant in changes. The new import of the changes in the 2024 PPS relate mostly to housing initiatives, which, well, I think McKellar supports, don't really become very relevant. I mean, the response to the housing crisis isn't going to be solved in places like McKellar. It's going to be in more urban areas. We'll do what we can, so to speak, but I think that we should be able to carry this task out without too much need to pivot, if I can call it that. So I have reached out and to the ministry, because we've still got to update the official plan for a number of reasons to get the 2020 PPS in place and to deal with some technical issues. I've reached out to the ministry because it has a provision where it's required to have to review the updated policy. I'm going to call it OPA number 9 because that's the next number in the chain, to not require the 90-day review period. I have sent them the draft that I've sent council. They don't have an answer yet. My rationale is that, you know, you've already looked at it for the 2020 PPS. You don't need 90 days. And I'm hoping they would actually get back to us before noon today. Will they? Bureaucrats aren't the fastest moving creatures in the world, so I don't know the answer to that. But if for some reason the PPS of 2024 come into play and they want to tamper with our proposed instruments, then we may find ourselves having to deal with that. But again, repeating that, I don't think there's going to be a significant consequence to it. So the goal I think we have today is to understand where we are, get a consensus on the public meeting, because one of the things we'd like to do is piggyback on the tax bills to get a notice for that meeting. And we want to examine the changes both to the official plan and zoning bylaw, which the zoning bylaw is about 12 hours away from being done. I just want to check what's going on. It's being the changes have all been made, but they're just being, some of them are just being recorded, and I want to be thorough in terms of getting it in as sound a condition as possible. So one of the things that we would need to do is probably schedule a meeting in another couple of weeks. Okay. But I would say that I've suggested that the formal public meetings occur at the end of the season, one being the Tuesday of September, after the Labor Day. The rules are that where you're doing an updated policy, you also need a public open house, which has to occur no sooner than a week before that public meeting. So I'm suggesting the August, whatever the week before September 3rd is, maybe August 27th. But you can advise me of the appropriateness of those dates. So between now and then, the first task would be to send the notices out. I'm assuming they go sometime in July.
Yes, mid-July.
So I gave you a draft notice,
yep,
which you know you can use as part of the discussion here this morning. Yeah, it's all very moving very quickly, and to a certain degree, I'm trying my best to get to where I think you need to be to not get challenged in terms of process. Hmm.
So that makes required notice if you're mid July and then end of August, you've got enough time in there?
Okay. Oh, yes. Now, I sent a memo too. I think council has read it on the royal assent of Bill 185. That has a very significant role in terms of this exercise, because it, like consent subdivisions and variances, removes the third party appeal rights, but for official plan amendments and zoning bylaws. So I think it has to be really clearly understood how significant that is. It doesn't remove the input from comments, but it does not need to terrify the process at the possibility of having go through expensive drawn out hearings. The only time there can be a hearing is if it's by a specified body or person, and that would be the municipality, a utility, First Nation. Those are the kinds of specified bodies. The way that it works is owners can make submissions, but they can't appeal. They can only ask for a party status when there is an appeal by a specified body. So, for example, MMA would have to appeal, and then if there is an appeal, a third party, ratepayer, or persons would only be able to join that by requesting party status, and they could not get party status if there was no appeal by an official agency. So it is a very dramatic change to the process. It's something that this provincial government has been attempting for 2 or 3 years. And the purpose is that they want things to speed up in the land use planning program. So it's quite dramatic. Do I agree with it? Certain parts of it I'm okay with, but I think it's a fundamental tenet that we'll come back to the process simply because it could be open to abuse. It means that really the buck stops here. Its councils has to make critical decisions on this land use and zoning matters, so that you understand that whatever you do can't be appealed. It's an interesting phenomenon in my mind.
Yeah, I just want a clarification on that because I haven't read the whole legislation, obviously, but it looks as if it's on a particular piece of property they use that so that somebody can't appeal a zoning bylaw amendment or official plan amendment on one piece of property. If it's for the whole of the township like we're doing and it affects all of the properties, I just need a clarification what the difference was.
Well, it would be thought to be something that, in my reading of it, should have been differentiated, but I don't believe it has. Mm-hmm. I believe that the process is that third-party appeals aren't going to be allowed. And you may need to seek legal opinion on that, but even the lawyers are scratching their heads that I talk to that specialize with that kind of legislation. Mm-hmm. So I don't think so is the way I would read it, but again, I'll chat up my legal colleagues because it's pretty significant.
Oh yeah,
very much so. Now what the province has done, interestingly enough, is they have given most municipalities official plan approval for site plan or site specific amendments, but they are actually not taking a very active kind of distinction between what is a site-specific. For example, in Whitestone, they enacted a policy change that allows for the creation of new lots on private roads across the municipality. Am I in favor of that? I wasn't very in favor of that. In fact, I would have thought that the province would have weighed in and said that's not good planning to create backlots virtually anywhere in the municipality. But the response that I got was we consider that a site-specific amendment.
Mm. That's interesting for the whole township.
For the whole township. And it literally kind of flabbergasted me because of the significant change. And no other municipality except for Cochrane has that in the province. So I don't, and they had a lot of opposition, the municipality, and the opposition, many of them were ratepayers associations, went to their province to complain, but the province wouldn't weigh in. So it's almost like the province is backing off. I don't know what the internal directives may be from Queen's Park, but that's what happened. So how they will come back and respond, I'm hoping this new guy, which is Blaine Yatabi, he's our new MMAH guy, which replaces Christopher Brown. I don't know if you remember that name.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Chris Brown is actually, he's in the same office, but he's moved higher up in the management of that office. He said as late as yesterday, I don't know about the one window question, but I'll get back to you. And I said, well, we're meeting at 10 in the morning, so can you get back to us by noon? I'm not holding out for a lot, and I'm thinking that at the end of the day, because there really isn't a lot of substantive changes in the new PPS, we can work it in. So I wouldn't get too excited about them saying, no, we're going to circulate it then. We know the typical response from circulating it to M&R, Culture and Recreation Affairs, MTO, they're all going to weigh in, and we're going to end up with another round of consequential points of discussion. And it is going to be what it's going to be, that's all I can say. So
it's interesting what you did in places here. We'll get into the more details later, but natural heritage, for instance. I mean, we had it all spelled out in different parts of the official plan, and now we're just going back to referencing the Natural Heritage Act sort of thing. Can that not be done with the PPS as well? That as long as there isn't anything contradictory within your official plan, you're going to be following the 2024 PPS.
That's the way I've approached it. You'll see where I've taken out references to necessary versions of the PPS.
Right.
And you know, it's a funny world. I mean, the province has been in control for so long of our land use planning program, you could have just stapled the PPS to a bylaw. In reality, I know that sounds a little cynical, but I felt, why regurgitate all of that material? Just say we will, and that's the way the system works. You've got to comply with the provincial policy statements in terms of being consistent with them. So why don't we just say it will be consistent? I also removed a lot of the specific policies related to triggers. And those triggers don't need to have that kind of complex language to spell out. Just say, if there is a natural heritage issue that must be dealt with, it's either in the PPS or it's in legislation like the Fisheries Act, where you have to comply with not harming, altering, or destroying habitat. Similarly, the Endangered Species Act. Those are legislative requirements that apply to anybody, regardless of what's happening out there. So we're saying to the world, you got to comply. And in the past, we've had a regime set up where if you're not creating any more than 3 new lots, for example, in the waterfront, you don't have to carry out certain investigations. We got away with that, but the reality is that if there's a heritage issue, or a fisheries issue, or a wildlife issue, or an endangered species issues, you don't have that luxury, so we just have to continue operating within those frameworks. So in many ways, I simplified the process. Another area where I simplified the document was with respect to lake capacity. The new regime out there is that there is no such thing as a trophic status lake capacity model that exists. What the scientists have found out was their assumption that development, which really meant phosphorus from associated septic systems, does not migrate to the the surface waters to contribute to additional nutrient loading, which they believe was fertilizing a lake, creating more vegetation, vegetation dying in a cycle, creating more detritus, more organics, creating a cycle of deterioration. What they have found in our landscape and geography is that there really isn't any migration in these highly mineralized soils. So the assumption of this migration of phosphorus from septic beds to surface waters doesn't exist. It binds within those mineralized soils right under the bed. So we had a rather elaborate, and this was a Michael Michalski thing.
I was thinking of him, yes.
This was what was the sort of workaround model in terms of lake capacity, but it in fact now is shown that the hypothesis of the model is not correct. Now it is correct, believe it or not, in southern Ontario where there are limestone soils, that the plume of phosphorus can naturally be tracked to any adjoining surface waters.
Sorry, John, I don't mean to interrupt, but your mic
fell. Oh, thank you.
You have to almost eat that to get it to work. So.
and that was a very significant component of our planning regime in McKellar, and in fact, any cottage country on the shield. So I simply felt it was appropriate just to remove it. Now, we're not suggesting that we don't care about water quality. We do. But the way to do that is now through a more biophysical kind of best management practice regime. You know, don't disturb soils, don't impair fish habitat. That kind of thing, including what densities you have in your official plan and zoning bylaw for particular water bodies, now far surpasses the notion, the wrong notion, that you were creating adverse impacts on water quality by adding development.
Couple quick questions on that. Are the ministries on board with this, the new approach? Because obviously the MOE and the Municipal Affairs, because they are really touted the Lake Capacity Assessment Handbook, and this is why quite often we come up with Michalski's approach to the trophic status, because it wasn't to debunk necessarily the Lakeshore Capacity Assessment Handbook, but it didn't really apply to a lot of the cases, as you say, in this township. I'm just wondering where that sits right now, because as recently as last year, people were still referencing Lakeshore Assessment Handbooks.
Your question and your point is quite correct, and the reality is that the province will not update that particular guideline or tool. They will not fight or dispute the new findings of the trophic status model that has been debunked. And now, when you go back to the sort of the new wave of Michalskis out there, they say no such thing. So it's done. So you go to even Michalski's active partner, Gordon Nielsen, says we don't do that anymore. Recreational boating, we don't do that anymore. You go to Hutchison, Neil Hutchison, he was a guru who worked for the early lake capacity model people like the Dr. Dillon. You might remember the Dillon model. They were the ones that created that, and they all worked diligently to towards this notion that any adjacent development to a shoreline would contribute to the adverse impact of that chemically, which was the nutrient phosphorus. All of those people now, no. They will. What they'll go in is they'll go in and address a development and say, this is how you can best manage the impact of that development on that particular water body. And it's going to come down to protecting fish habitat, minimizing vegetative disruptions, but nothing really related to the capacity of a lake.
Now this, I don't want to keep interrupting here, but the you say that the new approach, are there empirical studies? I mean, is there, you talk about the gurus and the ones that promoted this previous, do we have them today? I mean, things evolve, yes, and you get new information and ideas change. But is there anything that can be referenced saying that this is a new policy, rather than just saying that things have changed and we no longer use that old approach?
I think if we were to rely on a science, you would rely on the most current science. Why the province doesn't get around to offering that kind of updated program is a little sad, but you know, moving heaven and earth is really easier than getting a province to shift. So I can't answer that because I don't know when they're going to come on board. When you would say, are you going to lose the Lakeshore Capacity Assessment Handbook, they'll say, well, it's got some useful tools in there. And those tools relate more to things like vegetation preservation, buffers, minimize fertilization on shorefront properties. So they haven't thrown it out, but the real core of its import is no longer relevant. So if you wanted to get a comfort level, you would get someone in the current world of biology to talk to you. I mean, we got Mikulski in OPA 7 11 years ago because, you know, he was the front sort of guy in all these kinds of capacity issues, but now it's gone. And one of the leaders was Hutchison, but you talk to that man today, and you know, he's done a 180. I mean, he crusaded, he created it, but he's not there today. Now his minions are being hired to offer up the current affairs. Like we've hired, or I haven't hired, but municipalities and applicants on Lictra lakes, like Lorimer Lake, have used Hutchison to really confirm that there is no issue if you do this and this and this with respect to a lake that's deemed to be at capacity for lake trout purposes. So all I can say is that it's ironic, but those who are supporting a non-development model are probably the more aged cottagers that don't have correct technology or the most recent technology in their waste disposal systems. They're the problem. Mm-hmm. New development is not the problem. And that's unfortunately the reality of today. So within
I know we'll get to that too, you left in the specific lake policies, which reference the trophic statement, etc., and then you're taking out the definitions?
Well, I thought that at the time, it was good work. Mm-hmm. You know, it was within that framework of the notion that, you know, we didn't want to see any degradation of the water quality. But it turns out now that it's just data. It doesn't have any consequence because of this understanding that the migration doesn't move on modern septic systems. So you
don't anticipate any harm of leaving that information in?
Only because it was such good work.
There
was a lot of resources spent on that, in my understanding. I don't know if you recall, but it was not inexpensive for one thing.
Oh, I remember.
Yeah. So I just didn't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I just thought, let's leave that technical information in, but. No matter what the conclusions or the values are, they're not going to be adversely impacted, which What council and the municipal planning board have to look at is other things. What's the impact on deed, on the fishery, on wildlife, on wetlands? What are the significant constraints? It really kind of makes the zoning standards and the official plan physical standards the most important things. So, and if you read most of the conclusions of those SLIC specific policies, it goes back to saying, yeah, your zoning standard is good for moving forward with respect to that
right.
body of water.
Yeah. So, yeah, it talks about the mitigation of the phosphorus that would be deposited into the lake from the development. But one of his last statements in each one, I think Mikulski's, was that you could still have development. It'll depend on mitigation measures. You can't stop development. I'm just questioning, I guess, why the definitions. Will it make much sense to people reading this if they see the specific lake policies and yet they won't know the different holographic, I don't know all the terms, but all the different levels of lakes? You've taken out the definitions. Should we not leave those as well so that it makes some sense of either that or take everything in?
Well, that's I think, a discussion point.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no such thing as... eutrophic, mesotrophic, or oligotrophic.
Yeah, those are the words I was trying to get.
Yeah, so eutrophic is one that's over 20 milligrams per liter of concentration. Meso, middle trophic, was the one between 20 and 10, and 0 and 10 was oligotrophic. So that system was an integral part of the lake capacity program based on the trophic status, which said, well, you can raise a lake's trophic status on the assumption that all the phosphorus is going as long as you didn't jump into the next level. But because it's gone, is there a need? I don't know. And so the point is, should we leave them in or leave them out? But
wouldn't it be confusing if it's in there?
Well, that's what I'm wondering, if it's no longer applicable.
Yeah. Yeah. So I would think to remove it.
I mean, the Lake Partnership Program, is it still in effect? Do we know if our associations are collecting phosphorus?
Yes. Yeah.
So, I mean, I don't want to dissuade them from taking an active role in understanding lake chemistry, but those don't have a lot of value anymore in terms of saying, oh, here's our phosphorus levels, because it is what it is. Going back to the core of the model, about 85% of this was this was part of the hypothesis. They said that 85% of the loading of nutrients on a lake come from atmosphere and terrain, wetlands and drainage and that sort of thing. And the assumption was 15% came from septic systems. Now it's 100% atmosphere and other natural inputs like wetlands and streams.
It's interesting because there was somebody talking about the wetlands not having that much influence either. So one of your meetings that you had.
John, I mean, I'm a member of the Lake Stewardship and Environment Committee here. I'm between that committee and the Manitowabing Lake Community Association, the Lake Association. They do water testing on a number of lakes. I don't know the exact number, but not just Manitowabing anyhow. And right at the moment, actually, we're seeking some water testers for some of the lakes because the people that have been doing it are retiring. Sorry. Sorry about that. And I wonder, would you spend, maybe a half an hour talking to the committee, because on there are a couple of professors, full-on professors, that deal with this, and I would suspect they know infinitely more than I do anyhow, and it would be a value, and there's also an associated expense, of course, with doing the water testing that's borne in part by the Lake Association and part by the township. So I think these are all critical features for the committee to understand, and the council too, but I think it would be of great value to the committee if you could share that, just what you just said in the last 10, 15 minutes. But
And I don't mind that. for sure, but I am a land use planner right. who's worked alongside these guys yeah. for 50 years and watched the evolution of the science. You might be better served by getting someone like a fellow named David Leader.
Okay.
David Leader is with Hutchison Environmental in Bracebridge.
Okay.
And I would be worried, Nick, about me being challenged, being not in my lane.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he's a pretty solid guy.
Okay.
For sure.
Okay.
And there are others too.
Sure.
And they are all sort of on the same page with respect to that. So good point.
We could always do it in the background and just have a one-off conversation about it anyhow, just to make sure that we're going to the right places to get that information. That's
yeah, and as I said, I would not want to discourage associations taking active roles in understanding their lake chemistry.
Yeah.
So, and I wouldn't challenge a professor because they get into the
weeds.
Pardon the pun. Yeah, correct. Yeah. So, and they're very helpful in understanding that. But when you're tying things into the land use policies of the municipality, it's a kind of a different creature.
Yeah, yeah, I understand. I mean, it's really for the committee and or the township is just an understanding of what's changed and what does it mean, so that we at least tailor our future approaches to fit those. Because if it's of no value, then you know. But
There are talking points certainly today about the value of water monitoring expenses. Mm-hmm. Should it be done or should it not? I mean, clearly we know certain lakes are more sensitive than others.
Mm-hmm.
And that sensitivity, I think, now goes more to other things other than the chemistry
sure.
Of the lake. So just put that out there. And you know, who knows what we'll see. This may be one of the points of interest of the province, but keep in mind the province has provincial interests, and one of the things that's not a provincial interest is non-lake trout lakes, and we don't have those in McKellar. So the tipping point for M&R, MOE, for example, really relates to Fairholme, Trout Lake, Lorimer Lake, the lakes that are Lake Trout Lakes. And the reality is the same debunked hypothesis applies to those as well, and they're struggling. Because even though they're matters of provincial interest to support the Lake Trout lakes and the Lake Trout fishery, it's not the pure science they thought it was, and it's driving everybody crazy in the province. And in fact, to give you another example of how bad it is, the Ministry of Environment, which is now MACP, that approves communal septic systems, still requires a surface water nutrient impact assessment for someone that is building a large communal system. And the short answer is they shouldn't be asking for that. Because if you understand the current science, there isn't the impact of these systems. So it's strange.
They're just catching up to the science, I guess.
Well, they're resisting catching up.
Yeah.
They're going to be the probably the wrath of many local tourist resorts who rely on their approvals, because they're just so difficult to get anything from, and they've changed their rules to make it worse. So instead of, for example, using 250 liters a day per person in a campground or a trailer park, they've arbitrarily jumped it to 500 liters per day. So every campground, every resort out there is probably deficient because they arbitrarily change the numbers. And And when you try and ask them to explain that, they can't. It's a very frustrating world we live in, and I can't explain it. So here we are. So I went through the policy document essentially to do that, to update it with a little bit more robust review than say the old OPA number 9. But I think they're easily understood and explained, if I could put it that way.
There were just a couple things I've read. They turned to the document itself. You used the 2015 one. And I know the 2018, was it? But that's the one that was repealed?
Yes.
Okay. There were some parts, different clauses with different sections that I thought were still important. They weren't appealed. I'm just wondering why they were removed, whether maybe just an oversight that some of those, and I'll mention which ones they are in particular, it's something I think council had wished in there about who pays for what, for instance. And some clauses were removed in the 2015 one. They were actually in the 2018, which you put together. So I'm just thinking if we can look at those in some detail. Maybe
We can. I know the ones you're referring to.
Yeah.
And I think fundamentally they're still in the document in a way that I may be able to explain.
Okay, and I was just wondering, because if this was the one that was forwarded to the ministry, then some of those clauses aren't in there, but they might show up other places. You're right. I mean, just the way you worded things.
Yes. So I have to explain to you too that I had looked at the old file, which was somewhat painful. but I decided that I would try and go to an approach that just more or less explained why I did what I did on sort of the opposite side of the document. I don't know if that was helpful or not.
Well, what we're trying to do, of course, is to, I guess, appease municipal affairs, who still the approval authority, as you said, and also to avoid or mitigate, reduce any appeals. But as you say, the appeals may not be as significant as they used to be. But I think that's what we're sort of aiming at,
yes.
Revising some of these documents.
Yes. And I thought we were, we may not have been sort of where we needed to be, but we were closer than mm-hmm. we had ever been before. And the object here is to be able to say we're in step with the 2020 PPS.
Right.
Because that releases some independence for McKellar that we don't presently have. So.
And do you foresee any possibility? I'm not sure what the connecting link was with certain municipalities getting OPA authority and other most municipalities not. You still have to go to the province. So I'm just, was there any connecting link, do you think, with amalgamation?
That no.
Some of them actually, it's interesting because some of them actually got authority after they, in a sense, amalgamated or expanded as the government wanted back in the 90s.
The short answer is if at the time of the applicable PPS your document reflected that, you got these extra privileges.
Okay.
So that was the sole rationale behind it. Now, it's going to be interesting, this dynamic with the new representative, because his experience was Saskatchewan and Prince Edward Island. Now he's in the province of Ontario. But that may not be a bad thing, because they have different programs, but he'll have a broader understanding of what he thinks are relevant to the municipality.
Maybe just look at a couple of the clauses. You have that in front of you?
Yeah.
The document for them. And I won't get into all of the technical, that we can fix some of those things up. But I just, one clause in particular that seemed to, I'll use one, it's on page 8. I think this is something that you've added. 5.8. 0.81 or 0.1, delegating authority to pass bylaws. I wasn't sure section 34 and 39, but there's no oversight of council there then. That's the staff that can, or whoever it's delegated to, can change past bylaws.
And the issue is of a minor nature.
Right.
So
the question is minor. I mean, how do you define that?
I think that when you have a delegating bylaw,
right,
you define the word minor.
Okay.
So you let me put it this way. Many staff members don't want to have that kind of authority. They're not comfortable with it. So that is something that you have to kind of decide whether or not your administration people would be happy to say, oh, that's not logical in this case. It's minor. I'm going to certify a change.
Yeah, okay.
That flexibility exists in the Planning Act.
Yeah, just a question, I guess, that ultimately council is held accountable regardless of what staff does.
That's why I say many staff don't feel comfortable with that power.
Yeah. I mean, we get into that before, I think, with a complete application. It's come back now to, rather than staff declaring it a complete application, council has to. I mean, staff does all of the work and says that all of these have been received, but then we need a resolution of council saying that it's a complete application.
So, for example, Sigma Township, the planner there, determines a complete application, and if it's a site plan, staff approves it, doesn't even go to council.
Mm-hmm.
Carling, they have a planner on staff. He has a large list of delegated authorities that council never sees, including some bylaw amendments. So it depends on the kind of, I suppose, qualifications,
expertise, yeah,
and expertise you have.
Right.
But again, you would have to have a bylaw implementing that if you want to actually activate it. I mean, I kind of think of the council as being here for the most important kind of policy kind of structures and legislation, and sort of the everyday minor things. Leave it to your people. But again, you can decide what you want with that. You can stay or go.
Well, this council in particular, I think, is a very involved council and wanting to know what's going on. And it's a matter of meeting people out in the street, you know, the residents and saying such, and then the council is ignorant of what's happened. That doesn't look good either. I know what you're saying. We can't be overseeing everything that the staff is doing necessarily, but we'd like to be kept in the know so we know what the changes are.
Well, then I would say that that's not a good clause for you.
Yeah.
And the staff at Seguin and Carling, are they qualified planners?
Yes. Does it make them better than McKellar's? Could be.
It's not going there. Now, these are things that I'm pointing out that don't necessarily tie together. They're just following the numerical ordering,
sure,
in the document. So on page 9, under, it's 5922 now, I guess. Again, the word minor, extension of a private road. We used to have 180 meters.
That's right, and I find that putting numbers in plans generally, not always, is a red flag.
Yeah.
You know, you can get tied up in such a manner that you would regret.
Yeah.
So to me, it's more the intent. Why is it limited? Well, the whole purpose of the limit is to certainly convey the notion that you should have no expectation that the municipality is going to offer any services. So there's no magic in the 180. Could be shorter, could be longer. My history in roads is that once you get over 8 to 12 on a private road, they're going to end up in this room. That's my experience.
I'm just looking at the way you worded it here. Minor extension to a private road is based on the likely expectation that the private road may be expected to be maintained by the municipality. Should we not put somewhere in there, I think we have it in our roads policy, that there has to be an assumption by the municipality, and that at this point, there's different steps, procedures that have to be taken place rather than, I mean, the way it's worded, maybe that's what the public thinks, but I think they should be clear as well that there won't be an assumption or maintained by the municipality on a private road.
Yeah,
so maybe we could just add a language in there that simply indicates that you're only prepared to assume roads that are brought up to standards and accepted by the municipality.
Yeah, I think
that would clarify it. Yeah.
John, is the expectation here the expectation of the proponents or the expectation of the township?
Of the proponents.
Okay. I mean, that's logical, because it wouldn't be the expectation of the council, that's
no.
for sure. So.
All right.
Okay. And that was my question when I read it, was whose expectation? But, and so, David, you think we should strike this then, or?
Well, no, I think the whole idea is still good. That's coming out better now. I can hear it echoing.
Yeah.
I just wondered about the actual wording of it.
I
think it should still be in there. But I mean, that's always come up too, because people have pointed to, this lot that you're developing is beyond the 180 meters extension of a private road, so why should it be allowed? So I think, like you say with the figures, it's same with the waterfront. I think it said that anything beyond 150 meters is not considered waterfront. I think that's the figure we ended up with. But as you, once you put in numbers, then it creates problems too, because waterfront does extend sometimes 300 meters or right from the lake right to a highway, waterfront designation. But then now we're getting into situations where I guess there's a rezoning or whatever is used up, like there's a rural section as opposed to a waterfront section now in some of them.
Right.
So I'm just wondering about the actual distances. And I noticed you took out 180. I just wanted to clarify that.
Yeah, numbers generally are bad.
Yeah.
You want to. I mean, the language can be improved, and you and I probably can work on that. But it's more important about what the policy intent is,
right?
Than it is, because you don't want someone jumping all over the notion that you're 182 meters.
Right.
You're not in conformity with the plan. You're breaking your own rules. That's not what planning's about. For some people, they think that's what planning's about, but it's not. It's all about policy intent. In fact, there's very high-level court cases that say, don't read your policy the way you would a zoning bylaw or a statute. It's to be interpreted with intent in mind.
Well, I know that's something we did in the past. We actually put that at the beginning of a lot of the clauses. It is the intent of, because of that advice that was given. Talk there about further development. Those are other clauses that haven't been touched. So another one I have is on 59211. All new existing roads. The only thing there was there was another whole clause that was omitted in this one. It was in the 2018. And I'll just run through it quickly. Like it says, benefiting property owners shall be responsible for the financing of any road improvements, including all survey, legal, engineering, and construction costs associated with upgrading the road prior to its assumption by the municipality. And I just remember a previous council that was important to put that in there, so we clarified that they're the ones responsible for the costs. And for some reason, I was just omitted there.
Okay, I'll go back, because that should stay for sure.
I can get the actual wording for you. So. And similarly, on page 12, roads over crown lands. we had a clause 5951, we had another clause inserted on that one, saying that users of Crown lands for commercial purposes who cause any damage to municipal roads will be required to return the roads to their original condition at the expense of the Crown land users. And we thought at that time it was significant to keep that in there because it was happening quite often to our roads. As they were accessing the Crown lands for logging purposes or whatever, they were just destroying the township roads. I think it's just a question of using 2015 wording and not including what council had added in other versions.
Yeah, I will double check that too and make sure it gets back in.
So is that, David, is that 5.8.51 in the old one?
It's a new number he has come up with, so it probably wouldn't be the, because whatever's crossed out would probably be the reference to the old one.
I remember it, so I'll find it.
Page 18. There aren't that many. I'll try to rush through. At the top, it refers to the 5% parkland dedication. Just a question whether that's still applicable. I'm not sure anymore.
Sorry, what number is it, David?
It's
on page 18.
Page 18 at the very top, the second last line of that clause. It's either now or in the future by today.
Right.
5% parkland dedication is required by the Planning Act. I didn't double check that. It still is the 5%, is it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't think you'll see that go too far, too fast.
Okay. The other one was 22. Now, I don't think this is on 663, ABCDE. I think this may be in a comment from a ministry. I'm not sure where I got it, but there was an F. And it talks about, I'll just read through it quickly, and we can back check to see where it came from. Where the industrial use is proposed to be accessed from a local road, a study of potential impacts on the road, including traffic impacts, what upgrades may be required to the road, costs associated with upgrading, and long-term maintenance of the road, and implications for the township's asset management plan. I'm not saying council wants that in there, I just remember reading it somewhere, whether it was a recommendation of council or whether it was a ministry. Just talking, look, really I think about the township roads again, similar to the Crown land.
Doesn't sound like it's a bad policy to leave in, so
no, no.
It's just one that's omitted.
That's what I'm thinking happened, yeah.
Consolidated with Township McKellar, February 6, 2018.
Was 2018, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the, on page 24, or 26.
Page 23, we just run into this recently, so it's the just before your crossout there, it's still in blue, the second last line in blue. Accessory or secondary units and accessory structures. It should be buildings. We were educated on the difference between structures and buildings in our zoning bylaws. You'll be happy in flipping pages very quickly.
Yes, correct wording.
On 32 at the top, and this is, I'll just simplify by carrying this all the way through. If you recall, the permitted as of right uses, we had major discussions on that because of the word existing in the commercial areas in particular. And we had people come out to our meetings and were concerned that if they're permitted to use it, why is it only saying existing what they're presently using? So that's why we inserted in most of the clauses permitted as of right. That they're still allowed to do those things, they're just not doing them presently. They didn't want to lose the possibility. And yet I noticed throughout the document, especially for these special provisions, that's been removed, permitted as of right. Now, I know special provisions are specific to certain things that you can do with your property, but my concern, I guess, is what if they haven't actually used the property for those purposes yet? They're not existing in a sense because they haven't done anything with it, but they still can. And I noticed all the way through it, you must have had a reason for this, and I was waiting once you get your head around it. Permitted as of right uses, especially for the special provisions, has been removed throughout. There must be a reason.
But I think what we did, and
your definition of existing, I think, covers it. Because it includes permitted as of right uses. I think that's really good. But
yeah, and we went through all of the changes to say, look, does this need the protection of the exception going forward?
Right.
So yeah, they haven't got it yet, but we've got a table that shows all of the historic uses and which one we put in a generic zone because they've exercised that right.
Okay.
It just makes it much cleaner and more sensible when you go to a property and you see whether or not it's subject to the parent bylaw zone category or whether it has an additional exception.
Right.
So I think if you look at the two together, I think it would be understood.
Well, I know there was a convoluted language in a lot of our clauses, but it was trying to cover all of the concerns that people had.
Yeah, and you know, a lot of the convoluted kind of wording came to possibly defend against Bay Street lawyers fighting against our bylaw language, and they lost at the end of the day anyway because it wasn't looked upon as a kind of a gotcha moment. It's like, what makes sense? So I think we're okay, but we'll probably revisit that when we look at the bylaw update.
Right, okay. So I have that on a number of pages. I can just skip over those. On 39, this is what we referenced at the beginning. And I guess it's up to council, as you say, to contact the right people. It's the water quality 7.11.2. Since we're changing, or it's suggested that we change the trophic status, in 7.11.2, if we can maybe, again, contact or reference any people who have done their more recent scientific studies. I'm not sure they'd want their names in a document, but
any one examples of where the scientists have said?
Right. I'm just thinking it's such a dramatic change from what we had.
Well, it is. And driving the NIMBYs of the world crazy because they like the on-off switch or the black and the white. But I've got a couple, I think, or three that I can show you. Probably Lorimer Lake's closest to home. One of them, two of them were done by this guy, David Leader from Hutchison.
Yeah.
And those guys made a lot of, I'll call it, their earlier careers defending the Dillon Hawk. And now they're making it going backwards, turning it back in time. So I can give you examples. They're public documents, for sure.
And just below that, 71131. I don't know whether it was just a typo. The trophic state sticker Manitowabing was inserted, but it's really not referencing Lake Manitowabing as
no.
such. So.
So what are we
doing with that? Well, I don't
know
if you'll have a new title for it.
Yeah, it just needs a new subtitle.
Okay.
Prior to, it's just notes that you've inserted before page 41. Now these won't go in the document itself, I realize. But in your notes, you've given the reasons why the lake capacity methodology is obsolete.
Right.
I'm just wondering if your explanations have covered all of the changes. It talks about lake capacity, but there are other changes too, and I'm just wondering if those clauses cover all of the topics, and I'd have to look back to see. At the time when I read it, it seemed to me that there are other changes that aren't really explained by these comments, and I could be out in left field, but we'll have to go back.
Are you talking about like some of the specific natural heritage items?
Well, I'm just for this section in particular, there seem to be, yeah, I guess. Probably with the natural heritage, but it seemed to me that there were certain things that were talked about that weren't really explained in your notes.
Okay.
But I'll go back and check that too.
Yeah, it could be better explained if it needs to be more thorough, but again, I think as I was discussing the notion that I don't think we need to regurgitate the PPS. You know, when they circulated the PPS under the red cut red tape program of the province. I don't know, for those who were around in the Mike Harris days, I know you and I were, probably morally too, the pendulum swings like this. The PPS by the former government was about 60 pages. When Mike Harris came along, he made it 12. That cut red tape. And today we're running about 70, 75 pages. And this is very anecdotal. It doesn't mean much because it's more about substance than it is anything. But if this government really wanted to cut red tape, they would reduce the burden that the PPS represents. Because I can take the PPS as an advocate planner and shut anything down. That's just not right. So it gives you sort of an example that, look, if we have to subscribe to the PPS, we really need to talk about its general intent. One of the things the PPS says, for example, is that there's going to be conflicting policies. One that's going to say use services to their most effective level. One is protect sensitive wildlife. And a good example in my world, locally, of on the way into Perry Sound, where the Ford dealership is, has a parking lot for New Forest. That's been under a four-year turtle study. Yet there's water and sewer right there. Under the guise of the PPS, they've hammered that project, where in my world, and to interpret the PPS, is that if you are in a settlement area, which the town of Prairie Sound is, and it's got pipes in the grounds, the turtles just have to find a new address. And that's the way that the PPS is supposed to actually function, so that the hierarchy is dependent upon the circumstance. But yet, they're going to put that obstruction there, and that's probably why that project hasn't gone forward. They will go forward eventually, just because it's logical, and they're going to push. But you have to understand that you can't apply all the policies, which are in many instances conflicting, in all circumstances.
Yeah.
So, it drives me crazy that the modern planners are thinking that you can satisfy all of the policies, because you can't. It's just, you've got to look at things more logically, more reasonably. And I think the province has to go farther than it has, even in the proposed PPS, which, as I said earlier, talks more about getting as much housing out there as you can.
Yeah.
And even at that, I fight housing projects under the current government all over the place. Well, we need an archaeological study. Well, that can take years. And it doesn't make a lot of sense if your priority in a settlement area is to get more housing opportunities. You've got to be able to understand the priority.